Norm's Conceptual Corner.
Welcome to Norm's Conceptual Corner. Hi, guys. I'm here with my sanityist friends.
And it's about time.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've done a Norm's Conceptual Corner. John Marin, hello.
How you doing?
And Nick Arcus.
That is me.
So today, as promised and long awaited, we're going to talk about emotion and ethics with a focus on David Hume's ideas. And you guys know me. I don't really get too much of the historical stuff. So I don't want this to turn into a episode that is strictly about Hume. I want to, you know, just use the ideas of Hume to discuss the bigger issue, which is, what role does emotion play in ethics, if any? Mm-hmm. It seems kind of obvious that emotion's got to play a role in morality somehow.
Certainly.
Right.
I mean, we can think of examples of making a moral decision without the use of emotion, and that person would seem, you know, rather harsh.
We don't want to be Vulcans about this.
So. It's also hard to think of something I find immoral without there being an emotional content to that.
Yeah.
And Hume would have something to say about that.
When I say that's wrong, not factually, but immoral, there's an emotional context there.
Yeah. I like the way you brought that up. Can I think of any examples of something that's morally wrong that doesn't elicit an emotional response? I don't know. I don't know if I can.
Did you just prove Hume's point right there?
Well, I don't think so.
Shit, episode's over.
All right.
I don't think so, because there's always you need to figure out, just because something is associated with something else, if it defines it or not.
Right.
Remember the idea that we've talked about before, the difference between a defining characteristic and an accompanying or, you know, accidental characteristic.
Ancillary or
whatever.
Right. Yeah.
It might be the case that that morality elicits an emotion, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it is rooted in emotion.
Right.
I mean, there are lots of things that elicit an emotion that aren't themselves rooted in emotion. I would get really emotional if someone told me that we had just won $20 million.
Yeah.
But the fact that we won $20 million is a mathematical or economic kind of reality, not an emotional reality, right?
It doesn't surprise me, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if you kind of look at it from kind of an evolutionary standpoint of like where human beings came from, where we eventually developed enough of, I don't know, a kind of cognitive capacity to have a society at all, I think that you would have had to start off with basically emotional bonds that eventually we reasoned out and turned into some kind of morality.
Yeah.
Well, that makes more sense to me. Yeah. I mean, I think it has to kind of stem from it at the very least at some point.
Sure.
Yeah, the role of motive and emotion in dictating human behavior and even seeing it from a practical sociological perspective, it's you can't really consider it without it.
Absolutely. Of course, there's another danger, though, the danger of succumbing to the genetic fallacy, which is, you know, right, the idea, I think we've mentioned this before, that the origin of a belief is somehow related to the validity of that belief.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's, and maybe we'll do an episode on this, but I think it's pretty clear that human beings got our moral instincts from evolution.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you believe that human beings evolved, then ultimately all of our all of our automatic kind of responses, which emotions generally are, come from some sort of evolutionary pressure.
Right.
So the key here is, is that a good criteria for the actual goodness of something? And, you know, I'm going to argue that it's not.
Yeah.
And I wasn't arguing that it is, just that it's probably almost like an explanatory mechanism for how we got. It's like the emotions get you through until you get to the age of reason.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can kind of start to, discover more just through reason itself.
Yeah, try to work it into a system.
Yeah, I don't want to get too much about Kant about it, but I mean.
No, absolutely. Just because we got it from somewhere doesn't mean that that has to be the way that it defines us now.
No.
So, you know, but we'll entertain the idea. Lecture / discussion that I do in my classes, we talk about this example in the assigned reading that I give them. There's this, it's a little kitschy of an example, but here's the example that they work on. There are these two gals that are college students, And they're both all looking for something to do. Let's say it's over spring break or something like that. One of them finds out about an opportunity to volunteer at a local homeless shelter. And the other gal, I guess they're roommates or friends or whatever, she bounces the idea off the other gal. The one gal, her name is Christina, well, in the scenario. She's the one who discovered the opportunity. She wants to volunteer, but she wants to volunteer because she just is a super nice person. She enjoys bringing other people joy and helping others. It just gives her a great feeling inside.
She feels it's the right thing to do.
Right. Her heart is what's driving her. The other gal, her name in the story is Dakisha. She does not have any interest in helping poor people. Who knows? I mean, create as silly of a story as you want. I don't know. She doesn't like them because they smell bad. She doesn't like being around them. They don't have anything interesting to say. She can think of tons of things that she would much rather be doing.
They don't want to buy her weed.
Right. Whatever. Create whatever picture you want. But regardless, Dakisha feels morally compelled. She feels a sense of duty to help the needy out, and her friend is asking her to do it, so it's in her consciousness, so she does it. And let's say, for the sake of argument, that they both do it equally well, so that we don't mess that up, right? They both are equally good at helping people. Dakisha can put on a good face, and nobody knows that she doesn't want to be there. Which person do we think is a better person?
Instinctually, what do you guys say think? Christina.
Yeah. I think instinctually you would want to say Christina, as in, you know, this would be a person that I would want to hang out with because she's really nice.
Right.
Kind of brings up the idea of needing religion to be a good person, doesn't it?
Perhaps she's got just an internal motivation to be a good person,
right?
So we like that, and there's something to be said for that. Of course, some of my students say actually it's Dakisha who is the better person
because she knows that you know whether she wants to do it or not, she feels that she has a duty to do it,
right? And she acts instead of from emotion, which is somewhat arbitrary, she acts based on principles. And the real test of character is when you feel the need to do something, but you really don't want to do it.
I could buy that.
So it's not a clear call.
She's clearly not an egoist, basically.
Right. So what this story, I think, brings up is that it seems that emotion is somehow related to how we would evaluate the moral quality of a person. But it's not clear how it's related to evaluating the act itself.
Sure.
So, you know, this at this point, it's an open-ended question.
Right.
I mean, I'm kind of inclined to just get right into Hume at this point.
Let's do it.
Because right. Hume offers, and he, you know, he was writing in a time period where people didn't really, you know, like modern writers, list the premises and organizes readings with, you know, certain headings, and you know he's writing in somewhat of a it's pretty easy to read Hume, I think, but he's writing in still a kind of a flowing fashion. But I was able to isolate three arguments that he offers for his brand of morality, which we're going to call emotivism. And I just want to alert you guys and people listening that emotivism is one of these terms that can mean several different things, right? The term is ambiguous. It can mean an explanation of morality, a genuine moral theory, but it can also just mean a meta-ethical stance, which meta-ethics is a weird kind of field I feel the need to talk a couple of minutes about, though maybe we'll do a full episode on this in the future as well. But meta-ethics is not like moral theory, where moral theory is trying to offer, you know, the correct criteria for moral judgments and, you know, define what the word good is. Metaethics is a step back from that and is a concern that asks questions like, what do moral statements even mean? Or even more general, how, if any way is possible, can moral statements actually be true? What is their epistemological structure? Mm-hmm. Which is closely related to the idea of moral facts, which is what features of the world translate into moral right and wrong? Are there any? Is there a state of the world? that dictates a moral, you know, that you can say results in a moral fact.
Is this where Hume would say, like, you won't find it in the real world?
Yes. Yes, he will say that it's not real.
I think in his writings he says, like, look for it, and, like, where would you find it? Where would you point that out to someone?
Right. Yeah. Of course, he says that all about a couple of different things, not just morality. So, you know, he's a skeptic about a lot of different things.
About everything, pretty much. Hume's the kind of guy who, I said before to you, Hume's the kind of guy who leaves his house and looks inside his front window to see if he's still there.
Yeah, exactly.
You really get the sense, what do you know?
Right.
It does not appear that I am there anymore.
But you do get the sense that he was the kind of person who, like, if the sun didn't come up tomorrow, he would be the only person who's not surprised. It's just like, right. I thought so.
Yep. Yep, saw that one coming. I can't say that I can tell the difference between what Hume genuinely believed and what he simply kind of tossed into the fire as somebody else has got to make sense of this because it doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
I kind of get the feeling from reading some of him that he is taunting people to fix it.
Right.
But, you know, that's kind of reading into it a little bit.
And then Kant said, I'll see your challenge and
reason. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we'll definitely get to that. This is a good transition to Kant. But let's go through his three, you know, and this is totally my, you know, division. But let's go through his three kind of strategies of arguing for his general moral position. The first, I call it the argument from empiricism. So, you know, there is this longstanding debate in philosophy over how any statements are true or false. An empiricist believes that ultimately a genuine statement, some item of real knowledge, has to be rooted in sensory experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, the opposite position is just a denial of that, rationalists. Mm-hmm. The most extreme probably would be Plato, but rationalist believes that it's not the case that everything that you can genuinely say as knowledge is based in the senses, which, you know, requires one to ask, well, if we have an item of knowledge that didn't originate with the senses, then how did we get it?
How would you know?
Right? And so that's a problem. So it makes people who initially understand this question lean toward empiricism.
It kind of makes sense.
Or at least
when you just look at it from the top down like that. I mean, how do you experience the world around you? Just through your senses alone.
Yeah. We tend to think that.
Yeah.
This kind of reminds me of the like the ontological argument, not the ontological argument of God. Is that the right one?
Well, which one?
The one where we have a knowledge of God, but you can't possibly sense God. It's outside the realm of human experience.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm getting this backwards, aren't I?
I think you're mixing two different arguments.
I am. Never mind. Forget I was talking.
Pause for edit.
No, we don't have to edit that.
I mean, something else.
Ontological argument is the argument that if you understand the concept of God, then you already know that he exists.
Maybe that is what I'm thinking of.
Could be.
Yeah.
It's not based on the senses, and it wouldn't be rooted in the senses. So I actually thought that you were thinking of that.
It's a kind of weird argument where it's like, in order for you to even be able to conceive of a concept, it must be real in some sense, right?
If you conceive of the concept of God, that concept includes his own existence. Right. So only the fool would say God does not exist, because that's a contradiction.
That's right. That's what I was going
to. That's like saying this existing thing doesn't exist, mm-hmm. in which case you're stupid. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. We'll
it's a magic trick.
Yes. Yes. Well, an empiricist, which Hume was, you know, one of a handful of philosophers in the history of epistemology who kind of made empiricism, kind of, how do I put this, developed the idea of empiricism.
Yeah. When I think of empiricism, I usually think of Hume.
Yeah.
I think most people do.
Yeah. I mean, there are others, Locke, Berkeley. Some would say that in a way Aristotle was an empiricist.
Was Hobbes?
I believe so, but I don't know.
He was, wasn't he?
I don't know for sure. I know I associate Hobbes with materialism, not in epistemological views. But I'm sure that he's. I'm sure somebody knows that.
There's a conspiracy theory that he was also Shakespeare.
Hobbes?
Yeah, I wouldn't give it much weight.
I thought it was Francis Bacon.
There's that one too.
I think that one has some weight to it, doesn't it?
A little bit more than Hobbes.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
Hobbes' writing is not nearly as eloquent.
I know.
That's what he wanted you to think.
It's a little, I mean, he's not a bad writer, but no. It's a little terse in places.
Yeah.
It's short sometimes, or nasty, or brutish.
Oh, man. How do I recover from that?
It's funny to three people.
Somebody out there will get that joke. an empiricist. Hume developed the idea. And what he does is he says, what are examples of just statements that are technically true? Okay. Let's provide a landscape of how statements can technically be true. One way is that they can be truths of sense impressions, which would be, starting off would be statements about, common physical statements like Chalmers beer is on the table. That kind of statement. Oh, now it's not on the table.
Now it's in his body.
That's right. That kind of statement, your garden variety, empirical kind of statement, those have a connection to the outside world. So what makes them true? Well, you verify them by your senses. Okay, we understand those reasonably well, intuitive. The other term that he used for statements which can result in truth are relation of ideas. So, if I say all bachelors are married, that is a statement that is true. But I don't need to, look out in the world to verify this. If I say the word car is a noun, that statement is true.
Yeah.
But that's not physically true.
Right.
Right. So Hume said, those are two kinds of statements that you can technically make which are true. If you make them wrong, they'll be false. But they're in the true-false game.
Where would I think, therefore, I am fall? Is that just tautological?
He would probably say it's a relation of ideas.
Okay.
Yeah. That's an interesting question.
Isn't it? Because it's...
He was after Descartes. I wonder if he said anything about the cogito.
Because I can kind of see how you could call that a sense impression.
I honestly do not know the answer to that question.
Okay. Just curious. Yeah.
I would think that he would think it's a tautology.
I do too. And I've always called it a tautology and considered it a tautology, but...
Yeah. But, I don't know, if I put my Hume hat on, I would say, well, you got to clarify what it is you mean by that. Are you experiencing something?
Yeah.
I'm experiencing, and does I exist mean I'm experiencing something? In which case the statement means I'm experiencing things and therefore I'm experiencing things.
Right.
Which would be a tautology.
Right.
But I'm just spitballing here.
Okay.
From Chalmers.
My attitude, putting on a Hume attitude.
Descartes walks into a bar. The bartender says, "Hey, what you thinking about?" He says, "Nothing," and disappears.
You haven't heard that one?
No.
I told that same joke to my students this past week. They found it pretty funny.
Did they?
Mm-hmm. They liked it.
I like, how many solipsists does it take to screw in a light bulb? All of them.
I don't get it.
Because you're a solipsist, you think you're the only one that exists.
Oh. See, there's a bunch of different light bulbs. That's messing with my head. All right, so for Hume, relations of ideas are not genuine knowledge. They're tautologies. When I say all bachelors are unmarried or car is a noun, that's tautology because the word car is defined as a noun, so you just said a noun is a noun. Big whoop. All bachelors are unmarried. Well, unmarried is built into the definition of bachelor, so whoop-de-doo.
All bachelors are bachelors.
That's right. So ultimately, this results in him saying that, truths, genuine knowledge, are sensory, because those other statements aren't genuine knowledge, and we can understand why one might think that. So, that sounds like a possible worldview. We won't poke holes in that. We could, but we won't right now. Here's the question that we can say next. How is a moral statement true then? So moral statement example of this would be, say, murder is wrong. How would that statement be true? It's not true physically, right?
Right.
There's not something like murder out there in the world.
Right. There's not some, murder particle.
Right.
Yeah.
Or wrongness particle.
Right. It's a judgment about an act. It's not a
right
description of a phenomenon.
Right.
Murder is, but murder is wrong. Do you see what I mean?
Well, murder, we'll clarify this shortly. So here's what I like to say, though, to wrap this up. the idea that murder is wrong is not in the physical world, because if it were, then you would have like people in crime labs like finding the wrongness of a murder. Hey, yeah, I just discovered the wrong particle in this murder.
It turned
murder.
Pink. That means it's wrong.
There we go.
CSI would be different. Shiny black light. Look at this. Different. Murder all over the place.
Yeah, there's wrongness in this room.
I had to cancel podcasting last week because I had so many wrong titrations to do.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, this would be absurd.
Yeah.
So, okay, we can buy it at that point. But I have my own little side note on this. Technically, the phrase murder is wrong is a relation of ideas and is a tautology, if you look at it in this way. Because murder is a different word or different concept than killing.
True.
So how do you differentiate between killing and murder? You know, we could spend a few minutes talking about that, but I don't think we need to. I think it's safe to say that the difference in concepts is one is has a reference to the moral wrongness of the act and the other doesn't.
Yeah.
So when you say that something or someone was killed, that is just technical information. That does not imply that it was necessarily wrong. So, you know, a person can be killed in an accident. You report back and saying they were killed. That we know that that's not morally wrong. That's something that just happened. That's, you know, not a good thing, but not bad in a moral way. Or, you know, you kill a bug. You know, that's not going to be murder unless you're an extreme animal rights kind of person, right? Or a Jane. So, okay. Technically,
you're trying to wrap your head around.
It took me a second. Yeah. Oh, Jainism.
Jainism.
Got right. It.
Not a girl, Jane.
I know.
Okay. Which I'm sure you've dated one.
Even Peter Singer's like, nah, bugs are okay.
Yeah, yeah. They don't feel pain. So if the term murder is a morally charged word, then when you say murder is wrong, what you actually mean is a morally wrong act of killing is morally wrong.
Wrong yeah. Things are wrong.
Right. Which like, is a tautology.
Bad things are bad.
Yeah, those are bad. Because they're bad.
It would be bad.
It would be. Don't cross the streams. I can't. You can't distract me with these movie references. So technically, when you say something like murder is wrong or other moral statements, you could be falling into tautologies. So let's fix that. How about we say something like stealing is wrong? Maybe that has a moral reference to the word stealing as opposed to taking. But I'm not sure that it does.
It seems to me like it's kind of the same thing as the murder.
You think?
She stole my heart. It's a joke.
A metaphor.
Yeah.
So you think the word stealing has morality built into it? Is different than taking?
Yeah.
Well, what's the difference between stealing and taking?
I think the same general thing that I think if you said that someone stole something, you're it carries... As I understand it, it's a negative connotation. They weren't supposed to steal something.
Well, just because you're allowed
sometimes to take things.
Just because something carries a negative connotation doesn't mean that the negative connotation is built into that concept. I mean, I have a negative connotation about, I don't know, the Ford Pinto.
No, but I mean, I guess I look at it as like, is there any way you could ever think of murder and have it not feel like it's a wrong thing?
We've already covered that word has
right, but I feel like stealing to me is the same thing. When I think of stealing, it doesn't. I can't think of a time when it's okay to steal something.
Yeah, I don't.
If it is, then it's not stealing.
I don't think I don't think that just because stealing is always wrong, that means that moral wrongness is built into the concept of stealing.
How is it built into the concept of murder but not stealing? Like I said, I don't see it.
Because I think the word murder means a morally wrong act of killing. That's just what the word means. I don't think the word stealing means a morally wrong act of taking.
You don't? I think it does.
I think it means taking something that does not belong to you without permission.
I don't see how that's... That to me seems like it's the same thing.
Taking something is technical, right?
Right.
It not belonging to you is technical.
Right.
That's not... And without permission, that's technical as well.
I still don't see the difference.
Ownership isn't necessarily a moral...
No.
Moral ownership of something.
No.
For instance, you know, Robin Hood. Robin Hood stole from the rich and gave to the poor. Would we say that Robin Hood was immoral?
The act of stealing, I think, I still think you probably would have to.
Well, it could be the case that stealing is always wrong. That doesn't mean that the wrongness is built into the concept of stealing. could just be an automatic result.
I'll just let you move on from this. I still don't see it.
You don't see it? No. Okay. Well, we can choose something else. How about if I were to say, you know, just to keep it morbid, how about random killing? That's a technical term, right? That means killing without actually knowing or choosing deliberately.
That's better for me.
Does that work for you?
Yeah.
All right. Fair enough. We'll talk about that then. So how about we analyze the statement, random killing is wrong? So we figured out that the term random killing is a technical kind of term that doesn't include a moral language or moral concepts in it. So now we'll ask, in what way is that statement true? Is it true of sense impressions? It's not in the physical world still, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a relation of ideas? It's not, because the meaning, you know, saying it's morally wrong isn't built into the word random killing. So it's not a relation of ideas. It's not defined as... Everybody cool so far?
Right. I agree.
So what would Hume say? Well, Hume would say that in the two corridors that you've gone down, it's neither. So if those are the only two, then it's just not true at all. Now, that seems kind of bleak, because we all think that it's true. And then he would say, okay, here's what's actually going on. What's actually going on is that when you say random killing is wrong, you're not actually talking about random killing. You're talking about yourself. And linguistically, there is a problem that is known, that we sometimes ascribe properties to a thing, but in reality, we're not even talking about that thing. We're talking about ourselves.
Sure.
Are we talking specifically about how we feel about that particular
thing? Exactly. Yeah. But we phrase it in a way that makes it sound like we're talking about the thing.
A claim about the object rather than a claim of preference about
right.
the object.
And a good example of that would be if I, you know, which I haven't had this in a long time, but I'd like to use this example. Ben and Jerry's brownie batter ice cream. Have you had that?
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's stupid. Have you ever tried it?
No, no.
Oh, my God. I'm not kidding around. It is the stupidest kind of ice cream you could possibly have.
We're at a break here for some ice cream.
No, it's if you like if you don't like chocolate, well then I think that's a little weird. But
how much does Ben and Jerry's owe us now? For the little plug.
Because we've said this before, haven't
we? I think so.
I think we have too. It's been so long. Crap.
We're being sued by Ben and Jerry's.
No, I don't think they would. You know, yeah, they would have to send us something. Yeah, the stuff is ridiculous. So if I say Ben & Jerry's brownie batter ice cream is good, it sounds like I'm talking about Ben & Jerry's brownie batter ice cream.
Yeah.
But I'm not. That statement translates into, I like Ben & Jerry's ice cream. Mm-hmm. So the actual subject is me. The predicate is, I have this affinity for Ben & Jerry's brownie batter ice cream. And so linguistically, we can talk about things in a way that makes it sound like we're talking about those things, but in reality, we're talking about ourselves. So this is exactly what Hume would say about the statement, random killing is wrong. He would say, you sound like you're talking about random killing, but you're not. You're talking about yourself and your emotional state as to how you react to the thought of random killing. And this is another realm of the physical world for Hume. He talked about internal senses as opposed to external senses. So external senses would be information, you know, from our five senses, roughly. I see the beer bottle on the table. So when I say the beer bottle is on the table, that's information that I see. If I'm in doubt because I might be seeing things, I can reach out and touch it. Those are my other senses. See, there it is. And I know that it's real. So, but we also have this world of internal senses where I say something like, I'm cold right now. Or actually, in this room, it'd be hot with all this equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm tired.
I have a headache.
Whatever. I'm hungry.
Or you like certain things or not. Sure. Red is my favorite color.
Exactly. Red is my favorite color. Red is great. Yeah. Would be translated into, I like red.
I like red.
Red is my favorite color. The subject is actually you, not red.
Speaking of subject, we're talking about subjective claims. Like, those are also true.
Right. That's exactly what subjective means.
Right.
Subjective, I think, is funny. When people talk about subjective, they think, well, it can just mean anything. In a way, that's true, and in a way, it's not. I mean, in a way, it's subjective in how I word it. If I say Ben and Jerry's brownie batter ice cream is good, and you try it, Nick, and you think you don't like it, and you say, oh, I don't think it's that great, I can't actually look at you and say, actually, you're incorrect. That's not the way that works. But that's because I've only been talking about myself.
Right.
And I can't be wrong about my own feeling. It can't be the case that I say, I'm tired, and someone look at me and say, actually, did you know that you're not tired?
Yeah.
That's not possible.
Not the same if you say, I feel pretty.
Yeah. That would be different. Well, actually, you might feel right. pretty.
Yeah.
Let's talk about how that's related to what you are. Okay, so there's some linguistic work that needs to be fixed here, but ultimately, an explanation of how moral statements can be true, and this is a modern view as well, and this is where there's crossover, emotivism suggests that moral statements are not actually factual statements of the outside world. There are no moral facts. They are simply internal statements about our own emotional states. So it's kind of lovingly called the boo hurrah club. So when I say, you know, something is morally wrong, it's I'm saying random killing, boo. When I say something is good, like giving to charity, that's a good thing to do. I'm saying giving to charity, hurrah or yay.
Yeah,
that's all I'm saying.
So Stephen Colbert will call it the wag of the finger.
Tip of the hat, wag of the finger.
I'm Chalmer, and I endorse this decision.
There we go, exactly. So, look, I think that there is some truth to this, but I think that it makes sense to say that moral statements are these, you know, personal evaluations of some state of affairs. So when you're talking about them, you're not actually talking about that state of affairs. You're talking about an evaluation. Mm-hmm. I don't think, though, that that means that they are entirely subjective. I think that there is this kind of middle world. And, you know, Wimble will talk about that later or
some
another
sort
episode.
Of middle earth.
Yeah. And you're distracting me with movie references again.
It's like number 8.
We're going to do them all night, aren't we?
Yeah.
Hang on to your butts. Now I'm doing it. It's terrible.
He says hold on, though. So.
He does? Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't watch it 20 times like you did. I was going to say that you probably watched it 20 times before you got a girlfriend, but knowing you probably watched it 20 times with your girlfriend.
No, that would be awesome, though. If I had a girlfriend who wanted to sit down and watch Jurassic Park 20 times.
She hasn't watched Jurassic Park with you?
No. I actually don't have the Jurassic Park on DVD.
Really?
No. Oh.
Well, that's weird. Huh. Okay, where was I?
Middle ground.
Right. I think there is. But for now, we can just register that this is Hume's first complaint. That on the landscape of metaphysical reality, the only place that you'll find morals is in the realm of personal states, what modern philosophers will call introspection, which is examining your own internal state. Could be a mental state or emotional state. We'll get to that later. But regardless, that's the only location you're going to find them.
It's the good for you argument. Good for you.
Sure. And I'll tell you what, it's a little hard to figure out. You did it again?
That's not even a movie quote. That's just me tweeting.
It's not
even?
Well, it will really, be. Really creepy.
It will be. but we digress. I'm trying to keep these guys on track. It's not working. If you're going to come up with an alternative explanation of where these statements can be true, it's going to be hard to do. So we'll register that Hume. We'll put a check mark in the win column there for now.
Okay.
Here's the second prong of his argument. It's the idea that reason cannot motivate. So, famous quote from Hume, reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions and can never pretend to any other office than to serve and obey them. Or modern philosophers, a philosopher in mid-70s, he paraphrased this and said, reason is the pimp of the passions.
Nice.
Yeah. What are we talking about? That was Martin Diamond, by the way. Okay, well, if reason is the slave of the passions, what is meant by that is that we have passions. Those drive us to act, and reason comes in after the fact to kind of make things better, to help us out.
We reverse engineer our logic with what we did. We justify what we just did.
Right. We can do that. Or we figure out a better way to get what we want. But it doesn't actually drive us to do anything. It just changes the way we do things.
The way we value things, I think.
I don't think so.
It's not, I mean, it doesn't change what you want. You'll still want what you want.
Well, I would think I want to exercise more, get in shape, but then I reason that I don't have time.
Right.
Things like that.
Right.
So the, I guess it wouldn't change the value.
It doesn't. And you, here's the problem. When we say the word reason, the word is ambiguous.
Yeah.
So when you reason that you don't have time, that's not actually your powers of deduction.
Right.
That's your wants. Because there's other things you'd rather spend your time doing.
Yeah, I got you.
I mean, you have the same amount of time as everybody else, actually, technically. We all have 24 hours a day, minus whatever we need to sleep. But, you know.
Well, I also look at it as, like, you can't reason yourself out of something that you probably believe or feel, right? I mean, like the Ben and Jerry's thing.
That's great.
It's like someone can't say, well, here's my arguments for why the ice cream is not the best.
Yeah.
It's not like you're going to be like, those are pretty good reasons.
Yeah.
You've completely changed my internal... I no longer subjectively want that ice cream and think it's the best.
Absolutely. You don't have a whole lot of control over the things that you desire.
No.
Yeah.
If you desire something, you just desire it. Now, you can control what you do or don't do, but the desire, you don't have a whole lot of – certainly not direct control over
that. And some people took this to a strict determinism thing, which Hume was not, though. He was a soft determinist.
I believe so, yeah. I believe that he thought that there was some middle ground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Regardless, this is another one of his arguments that's kind of compelling. It's hard to show the flaw in it.
Yeah.
So, okay, just to make sure, because we've gone kind of fast, I want to give a scenario to people listening to explain how this might work, a starter scenario. So, okay, let's say that one evening after work, you find that you have a craving for Italian food. Okay, if that happened to me in Denver, by the way, I don't think that Denver has a whole lot of great Italian restaurants. I think we've got a lot of great restaurants, but Italian seems to be a niche that isn't really filled very well. We've got good pizza.
Yeah, great pizza. Some of the best.
Yeah, but as far as Italian restaurants, I just haven't found a lot of good ones.
I agree.
The only one that I can think of is a very expensive place. And, if you're going to spend... a fair amount on dinner, it better be good. So if I was going to try to find a good Italian restaurant because I had a craving, I might do various things. I'd look up reviews on sites and I'd look for directions. I'd look at, the ratings, I'd look at their menu, etc. Plan ahead, maybe make a reservation if needed, etc. Okay, so what just happened there? Did I use my powers of reason? Well, I did. In looking up reviews and making sure that I know how to get there, that kind of stuff, I'm using my powers of reason. But my powers of reason are serving my passions because I just happen to have a craving for Italian food.
Your sole function is to maximize the satiation of your desire.
Right. And, okay, so that's a good example. Here's what Hume is saying. Hume is saying reason can only do that, ever does. At this point in a class, I try to get students to break it. Try to come up with an example of where I'm in college. This is a rational decision. I don't really love being in college. It's a lot of work. It's a pain in the ass. And I'll ask them, okay, well, why are you in college? And that'll eventually lead back to that they want a better job. And, you have to be careful. We don't want to be too sloppy here. Sometimes you can say want in a way that isn't emotional,
Right.
So want can refer to the power of reason. So, if I have, if I'm trying to lose weight and I want to eat at a healthier restaurant, that could be my powers of reason. The word want might there not be emotional right there. But look, if you trace it back, it's going to be an emotion. Mm-hmm. In the case of people going to college, there are various emotions that drive them to go to college. Usually a desire to have a better job, and better job fulfills an emotional need, mm-hmm. either the emotional need of making more money and the satisfaction that you get from that, or maybe the emotional need of having a job that you feel more respected at. You don't feel very respected if you work for 7-Eleven. No offense to anybody who does. But, when you go to college, you can get a job that you can feel more satisfied with as far as, I'm not embarrassed in saying I do this for a living. That's emotion. So it's pretty hard for people to come up with examples of being motivated without an emotion behind it. Now, I'm not going to let you guys break this necessarily, but just as a side note, do you think that you can?
I would have to think about it. Right now, I've been trying, and I
can't get it. Not able to come up with anything right now? Chalmer?
Nothing off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking.
We'll get there eventually, maybe. Maybe not today. It's okay if we don't, because we can just kind of temporarily put a check mark on this one for Hume as well. Looks like reason doesn't motivate. And here's how this works. You can turn this into a syllogism. If reason doesn't, or rather cannot, motivate, and morality is a system of motivation, which, let's go slow and acknowledge that it is, morality at its core is whatever the rules are, trying to get people to behave in certain ways and avoid doing certain other things. Right. That's that's a system of motivation. That's trying to get people to watch what they do.
Yeah. I was trying to go wide with what I've been thinking here, but I still can't think of. I was trying to get more and more vague with applying, like, I don't know, some kind of reason to, like, some kind of big societal thing and trying to remove myself from it as far as possible.
Huh. Well,
to try and get myself there, but I'm still not coming up with anything.
Well, and I can think of examples where you would reason yourself to a belief that you would not necessarily want to be true, but that seems more like an accident. You know, some people might prefer to believe in an afterlife.
Well, having a belief is not an activity, is it?
No.
Why would you be searching for that belief?
Well, motivated to maybe curb the fear of the mortal plight.
That's emotion.
Right, by reasoning towards... trying to reason towards immortality of some kind. That's but then you find your
motivated
way.
Motivated by emotion.
Right, so it's it still doesn't work.
Yeah.
So that's...
People have taken this quite far.
Yeah.
So, why am I forgetting the name of this philosopher? Oh, it was William James. He proposed the idea that people who favor atheism are doing so simply because they have a fear of being wrong. It's an emotionally based decision. People who don't, who believe in God can be motivated to believe in God simply because they hope for what is good instead of fearing being wrong.
Wrong about what exactly?
Well, it's possible that God doesn't exist. The atheist doesn't exist. The person who is a believer, one of the strategies that they can use is instead of giving way to the emotion of fear of being wrong, they can just give way to the other emotion, which is the hope of something good.
It's almost like I don't want to take a leap of faith.
Yeah, that's kind of tricky.
No, I agree.
I agree.
People have taken this idea very far, and I don't agree with being wrong,
which is why... I try to dictate my beliefs on the basis of things that are more likely to be true.
That's true, yes. And, so, you know, I'm with you on this. But I'm just saying that...
That's kind of a negative connotation. You're just afraid of being wrong.
Yeah. It's a weird argument. It's not that actually easy to overcome his argument necessarily.
Just tell him, but I make up for that by probably being right.
So. Maybe we'll cover that another day. All I'm saying from that example is that this idea of the motivation of emotions can reach a long way.
I know plenty of atheists who would say they're afraid they're right.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, so if reason cannot motivate, then the syllogism is reason cannot motivate. Morality is a system of motivation, therefore morality is not based on reason. Because morality does motivate people.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't motivate people by reason, then morality's got to be emotional. Everyone see do you guys see that this is not a terribly easy argument to think of what's wrong with it?
All right.
Yeah. I actually really enjoy these kinds of moments with my classes.
Is the way you get out of this like to do some kind of like logic game theory thing with like the prisoner's dilemma or something like that?
I'm not going to say how to get out of this in this episode.
You bastard.
No. I'm not going to. Yeah. I'm just not going to go there.
Okay.
We're going to save that for another episode. We're going to leave people listening and maybe you two kind of messed up. And I'm okay with that.
All right.
So, okay. Second checkbox. Reason cannot motivate. That is going to result in a problem for making morality be based on reason. So, okay. Third part of this. I would say that this is part of Hume's positive theory, because Hume is a very smart guy. He doesn't just criticize things. He shows another way of looking at them. And this is, in general, a good strategy for any intellectual. It's easy to show where the flaws in something are. It's a little harder to come up with an alternative explanation. That puts yourself out there for other people finding flaws. So it's understandable to not do that, but it's kind of cowardice to do that, to just stick with criticizing. So he doesn't do that. He offers a positive theory. So here's the next step. Okay, and it connects with the previous argument. Reason cannot motivate. The only thing that can motivate is emotions. So emotion is the core of morality, rather. Morality is emotional. Now, a person who is really thinking about this, here's what they might respond. Okay, I'm going to entertain that you're right. Morality is emotional. Wait a second, I got a bit of a problem. There are times when my emotions drive me to act in a certain way, but I know morally I shouldn't. So I don't understand how that works if morality is emotional. And the answer to this is that, well, human beings have more than one emotion at a time. With the same thing in front of us, we can have two emotions or more that are in conflict.
It's quantum emotions.
Observer effects, right? If you have an emotion, that is not the only emotion you have. You have other emotions, and those emotions might be driving you in different directions. Easy to come up with examples. You guys want to play around with this and come up with a couple of examples?
I want to exercise and be more attractive, but I also want to not
exercise.
Stop playing video games.
Yes.
You know, things like that.
Yeah, sure.
Comfort versus vanity.
I feel the exact same way, except flip that with eating really good food.
Yeah, exactly.
I recognize that, you know, having that additional slice of pizza is not going to be good for me, but it's really good.
Yeah, I don't want cancer, but I really want a Big Mac.
Sure.
Things like that.
Sure. Don't tell me that Big Macs give you cancer.
I assume it does. Everything diet, does nowadays. So.
Diet's high in refined sugars and
refined fats. Sugars. That's what I don't fats. Like about fast food is the refined sugars. I can deal with the fats and proteins.
It's associated with a higher risk of cancer. There's not a direct correlation or a causative correlation, but there is a statistical correlation between poor diet and the onset of cancer.
Makes sense. I would actually guess that Burger King has more carcinogens than...
Probably.
Because it's flame broiled.
Well, they're the king.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah, they are.
Cancer king.
Yeah, sure. We know kings don't last long.
No, they don't.
Conflict of emotions. So this explains why morality could be emotional and that sometimes you're driven to do something wrong and you want to do that, but you also recognize that it's wrong and therefore in a way you don't want to do it. So the way this works out, I think, is the rational person would say, okay, I think I can understand that. But then what you're saying is that morality is based on a specific emotion or set of emotions, and that's how it can contrast with other emotions. And at this point, Hume would say, yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. And this is the third part of my argument. My explanation for the existence of morality is based on one emotion, the emotion of sympathy.
I get that.
All of morality for Hume is based on sympathy. So here's the way I like to explain it. Human beings are this quirky animal that we feel the suffering that we see.
Yeah.
When we see suffering, we feel some of that suffering. Not all animals have this. I'm pretty sure you could be writhing in pain and the fish in your fish tank not even notice.
Yeah. He watches you die in total apathy.
Absolutely. Probably doesn't even recognize what's happening, and if it did, wouldn't have any effect.
He gets but hungry house, later, doesn't understand.
But the house cat's like, good.
The dog might probably, dogs probably feel some sympathy.
Dogs
they
do.
Seem to behave in ways that they do. I'm sure cats do, too.
They're actually, mammals and some birds.
Mm-hmm.
Not all mammals, mind you. But a good number of mammals.
Makes sense.
Either the suffering and members of their own species, or similar species.
Yeah.
Or in the case of domesticated partnerships, or
sure.
Close habitation.
Yeah, not all birds. Like vultures feel something different when they see you writhing in pain. Like, oh, yeah, he's a big one.
Yeah, but like the parrots, you know, like I have parrots. if I'm upset or angry, they actually get stressed out. They don't like it.
Really?
If you're visibly unhappy, parrots can react to you just like dogs.
Interesting.
They pick up on it. They pick up on visual cues. They pick up on tone of voice. Things like
that. That's really interesting.
Not all birds. You know, your parakeet's probably pretty stupid.
Right.
But your macaw or your African gray probably has more of an emotional connection.
Neat. Well, as far as sympathy is concerned, I think it's safe to say, setting aside, you know, cynicism about the human species, that human beings have this more than other animals.
Oh, yeah.
Way more. We feel suffering even when we see images that we know aren't real.
Yeah, fiction, cartoons. Yeah.
Reading in a story. We feel that.
Things from the past.
Sure.
Yeah.
So we have this way. I mean, we feel it across all kinds of species. We feel it to trees. We can see a tree that's got a disease, and there's somebody out there who will look at that tree and feel sad for the tree.
Can't you feel its pain?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, because we suffer on an abstract level. Yeah. We can put ourselves into a position. We can think about the future and the past, fictional circumstances.
Yep. That was a Ferngully reference, but I understand if you didn't get that.
Which one?
I didn't get it.
Can't you feel its pain? The tree.
Yeah, that is. I missed that one.
No, didn't get that. In fact, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Ferngully?
Really?
Sorry.
Not a Tim Curry fan?
Don't know who that is.
Yeah, okay.
Tim Curry? Sure you do. Horror Picture Show.
I'm going to let you guys talk about this for a minute, and I'm just going
to
snap.
You know who Tim Curry is. You have to have seen
Rocky Horror Picture Show. Legend. You seen Legend? Clue?
Let me know when you guys are done.
Okay.
Wait, the movie Legend?
Yeah.
Yeah,
Curry,
that was great.
Tim Curry is Satan.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Or Satan figure.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, I'm not sure I would recognize him if he was walking down the street.
I don't know. He's pretty distinguished.
It's quite an outfit.
Very distinct. You've seen Clue?
I don't think so.
Mm. How about Home Alone 2, for God's sakes?
No, I certainly didn't see that terrible movie.
Don't credit him with that. God. See, that was the emotional connotation we were talking about.
There we go.
See, it all ties back in.
So, if morality is based on sympathy, then Hume would say, well, look, when we see things that cause us suffering, when we see others suffer, that causes us suffering. Even the thought of others suffering causes us to suffer. So, okay, someone is killed. You feel the suffering of that person going through their last, you know, moments. And then you feel the suffering of those who will miss them. If someone gets something stolen from them, you feel the suffering of the frustration of the person finding that they've been robbed. We've all had something stolen, and we know how angering that can be, infuriating. We feel that when we think of others. So Hume would say, well, look, this leads us to create these systems where we declare that this is wrong and then we put people in jail for it, but it's all based on the fact that it makes us feel icky, and therefore we don't want to feel that. So that's why we propose these objective realities to them, but they're really not objective realities. They're just our emotional reactions. And that's really all there is to it.
Yeah.
And again, this is not terribly easy to find a flaw with. This does not sound ridiculous.
When I think of like utilitarianism, maximizing utility, reducing suffering.
Right.
It all seems kind of built around this idea.
It is a little bit. It does feed off a bit of, I've heard some people take it from Hobbes.
Sure.
If not from Hobbes, from Hume. So. Yeah.
Sure. Actually.
Same thing. You could even do it with social contract. Your motivation, you could say, is to reduce your own suffering, which if suffering is caused by sympathy, suffering of others, by ascribing to a particular moral theory of social contract, you know, you could move this into other categories of moral theory quite easily.
Yeah. I think you could see where people would have some difficulty with this, because it makes it seem like, you know, anything that you think is wrong, it's really just good luck, or like it happens. It's just a random chance that human beings happen to find the icky.
And
can't we all just get along?
You know, if we didn't, then it would be nothing.
We're going there, and that's one of the problems. But I just wanted to read this quote from, surprisingly, John Stuart Mill. John Stuart Mill said this. He said, "The ultimate sanction, therefore, of all morality, external motives apart, being a subjective feeling in our own minds, this sanction has no binding efficacy on those who do not possess the feelings it appeals to."
Hmm.
And what I think is interesting about this is, one, until recently, I didn't really catch that Mill thought this about utilitarianism. But this also points to a big problem of this whole view. Again, it's easy to look at the things that Hume are saying and think, well, this makes sense. The problem is the implications if this is right. If this is right, then in reality, we have no justification for someone who simply doesn't feel sympathy.
Hey, what about a sociopath?
That's right, exactly. Sociopath does not feel sympathy.
It undermines...
And that person could, like, based off of what Mills said, that person would just say, well, look, you know, I don't have those feelings. I don't have that. My brain doesn't even have that capacity.
Yeah.
Yeah, how do we make...
It's not icky to me, if you want to bring it back to what we were talking. I mean...
Can undermine certain legal judgments, too.
Completely.
It makes it... It's kind of like you say, hey, Hume, what's a moral theory that we can use to help us guide our actions? Sorry, no.
Yeah, there isn't one.
It's kind of like, yeah, you're screwed.
The whole premise of understanding moral theory is to find some way of making sense of morality.
Yeah.
And Hume would say there isn't a way of making sense of morality. It's not a make sense kind of thing.
Right.
It's just if by make sense you mean powers of reason. If by make sense you mean something that we can understand, well, sure, you can understand it. It's an emotion. You
can describe it.
It's an expression of an emotion. Mm-hmm. And we just make it sound objective-ish, but it's not.
What are you suggesting, that we can't get an ought from an is?
that's another thing that he says, which I would think is right. But if someone doesn't happen to have sympathy, then you know my complaining about them, morally speaking,
doesn't make sense. In sort of
doesn't way. Make any sense. It's like me telling you that you're wrong for not liking Ben and Jerry's ice cream. It doesn't actually have, there's no foundation there.
Especially if you talk about factual things, there's, you know, it's like complaining that a fish can't breathe out of water, or a certain fish can't, you know?
Right.
Doesn't make any sense to object to that.
Yeah, yeah. You're a person who doesn't have sympathy? What am I supposed to say about that? Well, what do you know?
Yeah.
And that's where it turns into, and this is why many people consider this not to be actually moral philosophy, but moral psychology.
Yeah.
It turns into psychology.
It really is.
And here's what I like to emphasize about that. It turns into psychology in that as a system, it kind of asks you to act like a psychologist in that you note the things that other people feel in the presence of certain stimuli and you don't make any judgments about it. Like a psychologist would. You know, if a psychologist is seeing a sociopath in their role of psychologist, they are not judging that person. They are just noting, okay, well, this person doesn't have this reaction. Okay, well, here's some medication that you might be able to take. Or, you know, what is the reasons for this? Is this genetic or is there some problem, you know, that you're, you know, not facing?
It's academic.
You know, it's...
Right, yeah.
Chalmers, you were saying how you could see, like, Hume popping up, like, in utilitarianism. Like, it's... You can... In a weird sort of perverse way, you can take it to a lot of weird ones, too. Like, you can put that into cultural relativism right there.
Yeah, yeah, that's another one. How
so?
When you're looking at your... If you're acting like a psychologist, you're just simply noting how people are acting.
Oh, I understand. More sociologist.
Yeah, sure, I understand.
You're saying, well, that's just how they are.
Yeah.
Psychological description bleeds into a sociological description,
same, like,
and that's
you can't make a moral
is.
Judgment, that's just how they are.
Yeah, and the project of moral theory is you know, is inherently not descriptive. It's inherently supposed to be prescriptive, where it's recommending a way of thinking that allows one to argue for moral truths, as in this is really a good reason to do this. To just appeal to emotion doesn't – it kind of disintegrates that entire project.
But we have no single premise on which to base any decisions.
Yeah. Well, if you happen to feel that, that's great. If you don't
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, an appeal
no
to emotion, it sounds like some kind of fallacy, really.
Please don't kill me, because...
Well, appeal to emotion it works if the conclusion is emotional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Appeal to emotion is a fallacy when your conclusion is factual. And Hume would say, well, no moral conclusions are factual. They're all emotional. So
right.
Then the reasoning wouldn't be flawed. But, you know, regardless... I think that it's perfectly legitimate to feel uneasy about this idea.
Yeah.
And I think that it almost starts off in too limited of a way, that this kind of two-part reality of just sensory experience and just relations of ideas, I don't buy that those are the only ways to make sense of things.
Right.
And, you know, again, I think I'd like to do an episode later about meta-ethics, but I'll just leave a little bit right now. if I say that this piece of paper that I'm holding right now, let's pretend I'm holding a dollar bill. If I say this is worth a dollar, that's not physically true.
It's conceptually, right?
Yeah, it's not physically true. It's not true of my inner sensory experiences.
It's only meaningful because we all agree.
Right. But it's not a relations of ideas, as in it's not this paper is defined as a dollar, as in if you look up this paper in a dictionary, it would define it. No, that wouldn't doesn't work either. It's defined in a different way. It's using the word define in a different way.
It's abstract, but it's not subjective. It's still objective.
Right.
Really, the entire system of economics in today's world is this. No one uses hard currency anymore. It's all you show someone a number in a bank account, and I believe that you have that number.
Yeah. How about I own this house?
Yeah.
That's not physically true. It's not just a state of mind. It's not like I feel like I own this house. No. And it's not a relation of ideas like this house is defined as mine.
Yeah. That's objectively. Not, objectively, you own the house, but it's not written into the universe itself.
So I just think that this starting point.
But you could feel that you own the house.
Well, I could. Right. But that would be a different kind of – that wouldn't actually be a feeling.
Well, I was just wondering, did I just break Hume's thing or not? I mean, like if you act in a rational way to upkeep your house because you feel that you own it?
No, because you're using the word feel in a couple of different senses.
Okay.
We can use the word feel in a way that doesn't actually refer to feelings. It's a way of just kind of softening, like saying I don't know for sure. I kind of think. Mm-hmm. And we can say I feel.
That's true.
Yeah.
So that's the problem with a lot. There's a lot of linguistic things that we got to work through.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that, I think that this starts from too limited of a perspective, and I do think that there is an emotional component to morality, but I think that it is tied to how we evaluate people's character, not the fundamental idea of what's right and wrong to begin with. I don't think that it works for that. But for right now, we better come up with something better.
Yeah. Right. I remember we talked about this in the first Norm's Conceptual Corner, theorizing about ethics, this idea that just because something isn't a statement about a physical reality or an internal state doesn't mean that it's not objective. It can be abstract, can be have no physical basis and still be a truth.
Yep.
And we kind of talked about morality in that context.
Like mathematics and things like
that. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So we'll see if we can do better with the next episode, which hopefully will be sooner. The next episode will be addressing Kant, and I think it's a good time to do that because, in many respects, Kant is reacting to Hume. It's at least
he said that he woke him from his slumbers.
Yeah, it's at least what kicked him in the pants to try to work out something better. And I think that Kant's system works well. I don't think it works perfectly, but it does provide a way. It provides a crack in the veneer. Yeah. Of Hume's argument, which seems otherwise pretty hard to penetrate.
Yeah, I think if he weren't stuck behind the lens of religious philosophy, he might have come to some better conclusions.
Perhaps. So
very smart.
Yeah, yeah. And I do think that he did something completely new. But we'll get to that next episode. Yeah. Thanks for engaging in the conversation, guys, as usual.
It's been good.
Till next time.
I'm extremely confused. I'm not happy with
that. That's right where you should be. All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, from Hume, we ask you to please feel responsibly.